Welcome to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. 30 minutes of tax justice news, scandal and analysis you won't find anywhere else. Every month with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, what's Scotland got to do with a $1 billion bank fraud in Moldova? But first, here are the Tax Justice News headlines for this month. In the United States, a bit of good news. The Treasury Department says it's worried about all the luxury real estate purchases by people hiding their identity through anonymous financial structures. Temporarily, they've decided to make title insurance companies identify individuals paying in cash for properties in New York City and Miami. What took them so long, and why temporarily? Predictions on the widening gap between the world's rich and poor have come true a year earlier than expected. According to Oxfam, the richest 1% now have more wealth than the rest of the world combined. To stop it getting any worse, the world needs higher wages, a proper crackdown on tax dodging, and higher investment in public services. Unfortunately, most governments are going in the exact opposite direction. In Australia, 8 out of 10 media companies that paid no income tax in Australia in 2014 are linked to the Murdoch family. That's according to new data released by the Taxation Office there. In the United Kingdom, it's a great start to the year for the banks. British banking regulator, the Financial Conduct Authority, is dropping an inquiry into banking culture. It's dropping an investigation into incentives for staff selling financial products. And it's decided not to take action against HSBC over hundreds of wealthy British customers who were potentially evading tax via the bank's Swiss branch. Last year, the UK Chancellor fired the former head of the Financial Conduct Authority, who was seen as too tough on banks, and is now busy watering down proposals to split retail from investment or casino banking, and he's finishing off recommendations that senior managers in banks should be held to account for misconduct. Also in the UK, you may remember last year, Prime Minister David Cameron wrote to the UK's Crown Dependencies and Overseas Territories to ask very politely if they'd mind establishing a public register of the identities of the real owners of companies in their jurisdictions. Apparently, only Montserrat and Gibraltar have announced any significant changes, while others are talking about implementing similarly effective systems. So, yes, they do mind. The European Union Commission's been busy lately, ruling that 35 companies who were taking advantage of a corporate tax minimisation scheme in Belgium owe the equivalent of $760 million in back taxes. Apple may owe $8 billion if an EU Commission investigation also finds its scheme offered by Ireland was illegal under state aid rules. Charmingly, Apple's CEO recently referred to all this as political crap. No, it's democracy, mate. Those are the news headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. OK, John, let's start in Colombia this month then, where the government has just sold off the state's 60% share of the power company Isagen. There was a really long fight over the privatisation of this very valuable Colombian asset. It was one of the most profitable energy companies in the country. There was a Tax Justice Network affiliate, Justicia Tributaria, which actually managed to get the sale suspended last year on the basis that it was against the public interest and it was unconstitutional. I mean, apart from losing all the revenue that the company was bringing back into the treasury, we've seen many times with privatisation of public assets, what tends to happen is the country loses tax revenue as well. The company tends to offshore the profits. It takes on high levels of debt. Bills tend to go up. And the company tends to pressure government for subsidies and money to improve infrastructure. So the more you read about this, the worse it gets, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, Colombians have taken to the streets again to protest the sell-off of this major and, as you said, highly lucrative state energy generating company to private buyers. And these private buyers are based in the notorious tax haven of Bermuda. Now, the previous attempt to privatise Isagen, this public electricity generating company, was blocked when civil society activists, and that did include the Tax Justice Network Colombia, challenged the government. But this time round, the government which is led by President Juan Manuel Santos, set up an extraordinary auction on the Bogota Stock Exchange, in which the multinational property company Brookfield, which is nominally Canadian but operates the majority of its investment activity through subsidiary companies in Hamilton, Bermuda, is the only bidder. And I've never heard of an auction like this at such a level with just the one bidder. Now, according to Latin American media, public anger is being fueled both by the fact that the government is selling off what is undoubtedly a key strategic asset, but also by the involvement of some shady middlemen who are close to President Santos and who appear to have been very influential in brokering this deal. So who are these shady middlemen? Well, one of them is former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who met President Santos through an initiative with the very Orwellian title Fundación Buen Gobierno, the Good Governance Foundation, and who allegedly introduced Santos to another British person who is known to his inner circle as God. His initials are G-O-D, so he used to sign himself up often cabinet minutes as God. More widely, he's known as Gus O'Donnell, former cabinet secretary to the Blair government, and now a non-executive director of Brookfield Property Partners. Now, just to stir up the public anger even more on the streets of Bogota, Brookfield has been accused by the authorities of Sao Paulo in Brazil of bribing the mayor there to secure planning approval for a very large downtown development. Now, curiously, none of this story, not even the connection to God and to the former British Prime Minister who thinks he's God, has been picked up by the media outside Latin America, and we wonder why not.
Right, and it's an absolutely terrible deal for Colombia.
Yes, and I don't think we've heard the last of this story, because public anger in Colombia is at a peak, and Santos will undoubtedly be challenged yet again, presumably at some stage through the courts.
Let's hope so. Let's move on and talk about the European Union. There's been a lot of things going on this month, some good, some bad. On the good side, we've had Belgium being ordered to recover $760 million in unpaid tax from 35 multinationals who were participating in a pretty outrageous tax dodging scheme that they were operating. That scheme was enabling companies to dodge tax on up to 90% of their profits. Sounds good, doesn't it? This Belgian ruling is very significant, isn't it?
Yeah, significant. I mean, at face value, the sums involved aren't huge. We're talking about 700 million or so at this stage around the Belgian excess profits scheme, which is just so extraordinary that a country like Belgium would create such what is so clearly illegal, so clearly designed to help multinational companies shift profits into Belgium, where they would be deemed excess profits and therefore exempted from taxation under normal Belgian arrangements, because the Belgian authorities would look at those companies and compare them with domestic companies and say it's deemed that the huge profits being declared in Belgium by the multinational companies were not actually being generated in Belgium and therefore were not liable to Belgian tax. I mean, it's such an extraordinary arrangement. But it doesn't stop with Belgium. I think increasingly the attention is going to be turned to the much bigger problems arising from Netherlands and, of course, from Luxembourg. And these are already in the Commission's sights. If the double non-taxation of profits in these countries is going to be examined and retrospectively taxed as a result of the findings of the Commission inquiry at what are the current applicable statutory rates, there we're going to start talking about really serious money. And at that stage, something interesting is going to happen. Something very interesting is going to happen, because the companies themselves will start looking to their advisors. And of course, their advisors are the big four accounting firms, the PricewaterhouseCoopers, Ernst & Young, Deloitte, KPMG, and saying, you have ill-advised us here. I think the whole thing is going to end in tears for the big four players as well.
Very good. And it seems to me that we seem to have a very good competition commissioner at the moment who's being very active in this area, Margrethe Vestager. You know, she's just come out in favour of public reporting of what multinational companies pay in tax, and she's just congratulated Antoine Deltour, the LuxLeaks whistleblower. I bet she's not dinner guest of honour at some of these company AGMs or corporate team building events.
You bet she's not going to be the guest of honour at these big events, because she is really stirring the pot. And one has to say, about time too. Years of civil society protest against these special tax arrangements about the dodgy dealings between tax havens and multinational corporations is now beginning to expose one of the really big fault lines at the very heart of the European project. As if that project doesn't have enough problems, the idea of the single market is being challenged publicly by civil society and by the Competition Commissioner, who's saying you can't have a single market where you have such anti-competitive tax rulings and tax treatments being offered to multinational companies. And crucially, it isn't just the American multinational companies, who of course have been extremely aggressive in securing these preferential tax deals, but also European companies, which have also been pushing for decades for preferential tax treatment. And now we're beginning to see the whole project begin to fall apart. And perhaps we should start by looking at the completely sham process that the European community started in the late 1990s, known as the CODE, the Code of Conduct Group on Business Taxation, supposed to iron out all of these harmful tax treatments being offered by countries like Ireland and Luxembourg and the British tax havens, and remove the market distortions arising from tax deals within the European Union. It did no such thing. It kept claiming it was making progress, but actually the progress it made was minimal. And perhaps, as some newspapers have been reporting, it actually made the situation worse, because as ministers and politicians were meeting through this highly secretive group, the CODE, as it called itself, they were picking up what other countries like Netherlands and Ireland and Britain were doing, and they were thinking, well, if that works for them, we'll apply it to themselves. So what's happening now is that parliamentarians coming out of the Green Party and others, but mainly led by the Green Party in the European Parliament, are challenging this Code of Conduct group. And the European Commission is saying, you can't do this. We won't actually allow you access to the minutes of this group, so you won't be able to find out what they're doing about this. That's now being challenged. A lawsuit has been raised by a parliamentarian, a German, Fabio De Masi, has raised a lawsuit against the European Commission itself, charging them with denying him and others the right to have access to the minutes of the meetings of the Code of Conduct Group. And it's very likely that the Commission will be found to have been violating EU law by refusing to share those documents with parliamentarians and with others.
Right, because he thinks that these documents, which they are not very happy about sharing, will reveal systematic political backup for a tax avoidance cartel that costs taxpayers in the EU hundreds of billions of euros annually. So they're pretty important documents.
They are very important documents, but I think, and I'll eat my hat if I'm proven wrong on this one, I'll eat my hat and you can choose the recipe for it. If these documents don't reveal exactly that Luxembourg, Netherlands, Ireland and Britain and other tax havens within Europe have been pushing very, very hard to minimise the measures taken against these harmful tax practices. And it yet again reveals how far removed the European Commission, of course, bear in mind it's headed by the former Prime Minister of Luxembourg, Jean-Claude Juncker, totally removed from public opinion, because public opinion increasingly looks at the European Commission and says, this is a commission which is not acting in the public interest for Europeans.
And I don't think you'll be eating your hat anytime soon, John. The other thing to mention is that the Netherlands has just taken on the EU presidency for this year, starting this month, despite they're one of the biggest tax havens in the world, busily kind of depriving their neighbours of tax revenue, obviously no block to power in the European Union.
I think despite the Netherlands presidency, the momentum here will continue, because let's face it, we're entering yet another period of economic crisis and political crisis arising from that. We've seen a policy or political arrangements within Europe which have been all about a project which is failing, the kind of neoliberal focus on creating a market which is so clearly distorted by their tax policies. They failed to take action against it. The whole project is falling apart. Austerity is being imposed upon the European people as a result of this, or partly as a result of this. And so far, they've done very little to tackle the problem. So I think the pressure is going to continue to increase. And I'm not sure whether the Dutch will be able to hold back the dike on this occasion.
John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. When we hear about the role of secrecy jurisdictions in financial crime, we still tend to think about palm-fringed Caribbean islands. But here's a question for you. What's Scotland got to do with the billion-dollar bank fraud in Moldova, one of Europe's poorest countries? Well, everything, as it turns out. These are the sounds of revolution in the former Soviet Republic of Moldova. Things were already going pretty badly there, but last year $1 billion was stolen from three of Moldova's biggest banks. That's equal to about 12.5% of the country's gross domestic product. The government bailed them out at the cost of half the nation's annual budget and nearly collapsed the economy. There have been mass protests there with Occupy-style anti-corruption camps set up outside Parliament. They eventually forced the resignation of the Prime Minister. The country got through five governments and prime ministers just last year, and now it's looking even more unstable. And I bet we're going to be hearing a fair amount more about the crisis in Moldova this year. But you might hear less about Scotland's role in it all.
It looks like Scotland is becoming the money laundering capital of Europe. This is frankly unacceptable.
Finance journalist and writer Ian Fraser.
Company formation agents seem able to establish completely fictitious entities, some of which are being used for money laundering and to rip off impoverished countries. I'm fairly inured to some of the corruption that goes on in this country. I was genuinely taken aback by this discovery because it just seemed so unlikely.
What I find really interesting about this is we'd never have actually known about English and particularly Scottish involvement in the Moldovan bank fraud if the Moldovan government hadn't commissioned a corporate investigations firm to try and trace the money. And the report they produced, the Kroll report, was supposed to be confidential but was leaked by the Speaker of their parliament.
Yes, that is an extraordinary feature of it. But of course, as soon as you know that, you know where to look, and then the lid comes off.
This is Richard Smith, finance journalist and blogger.
If that report hadn't been leaked, we'd be none the wiser now, I suspect. And that highlights, I think, one of the things that's bizarre about our current setup with limited partnerships and limited liability partnerships.
And without Ian Fraser and Richard Smith's research and articles on this, the murky systems churning out potentially dubious so-called confidentiality vehicles, particularly in Scotland, would have remained in the shadows. Ian Fraser again.
We basically discovered that, you know, there was a huge cluster of about 10 company formation factories dotted around Scotland. And they were based in very insalubrious parts of major cities like Glasgow, Edinburgh, Inverness. And we were surprised, actually, in traditionally the most run-down, deprived part of Edinburgh, formerly the place where a lot of drug addicts used to live. You know, it was like a one-bedroom former council flat in a particular address in that Edinburgh suburb was the home to 400 or 500 companies, two of which seemed to have been pivotal in the Moldovan bank fraud. And they were Scottish limited partnerships, which were taking on the assets and or liabilities of the three Moldovan banks that were bankrupted in the fraud.
These company formation agents aren't necessarily knowingly setting up dodgy companies or doing anything illegal. But listen to how appealing these Scottish limited partnerships are if you're up to no good.
The disclosure requirements which pertain to these particular corporate vehicles are minimal. You don't have to declare who the directors are. Basically, you don't have to declare anything apart from the name of the general partner and the name of the limited partner. These limited partnerships were first invented as a corporate vehicle back in 1907, and they haven't been changed since, as far as I can see.
Richard Smith.
Most of these are registered in an extremely opaque manner. Typically, they have a general partner and a limited partner in an offshore jurisdiction that is very, very poor on disclosure. So, for instance, you can find hundreds where the limited partner or the general partner is in some really seedy location like Panama, where you just can't tell who the underlying beneficiary is, or in the British Virgin Islands, or in Belize or the Marshall Islands, the Seychelles. You know, they're really tax havens or secrecy jurisdictions offshore, and you can't get any kind of handle on who the underlying beneficial owner is. And that's the key attraction, I think, of Scottish Limited Partnerships. They're an opacity vehicle, pure and simple. So while we've had this, you know, pretty good progress, I think, on enhancing the transparency of UK limited companies, limited partnerships are this complete backwater, and everyone's rushing into them. All the dodgy fellows overseas are using these things. Of course, you need a complicit bank, but there's been no shortage of supply of dubious offshore banks willing to open accounts for this type of vehicle.
Ian Fraser.
But what really stunned me was not necessarily the level of apathy within the political establishment or the fact that so few people are actually aware of any of this. It was really the scale, you know, the quantity of Scottish limited partnerships that are being created.
Right, Ian, because these Scottish limited partnerships have become really popular in recent years, haven't they?
These vehicles are today being churned out at a rate of about 5,000 or 6,000 a year, up from 500 a year in 2008, by company factories, many of which are operating from this twilight zone of modest ex-council flats in cities such as Edinburgh and Inverness. And according to the research that I've done, at least 90% of the Scottish limited partnerships that are being created have general partners in offshore secrecy jurisdictions, including the Marshall Islands, Seychelles, Belize and Panama. It's virtually impossible to verify the purpose to which they're being put, are also being marketed in Central Eastern European countries, especially Latvia and Bulgaria, and being touted as the most confidential corporate vehicle in Europe.
So they're getting a nice kind of veneer of the UK's supposed respectability, these potential money launderers and other fraudsters. But the Moldovan bank fraudsters' use of English and Scottish limited partnerships is just the tip of the iceberg. Here's Richard Smith.
Now, the latest figures may interest you. The sort of Scottish connection is known to be connected not with just 1 billion of money laundering, but with more like 20 billion running out of Moldova. The latest scuttlebutt is that the figure could be 80 billion cumulatively over the last 5 years or so, which is beginning to be quite a tidy sum. And so I think there are going to be more of these unexploded limited partnerships are going to explode in the coming months and years. And it is going to turn out to be quite a big problem, not just $1 billion and the destabilization of one country, but probably, you know, one of the main money channels out of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union.
You're saying $80 billion?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, right. And that money is going through these companies, say these Scottish limited partnerships or shell companies based, registered in the UK.
That's basically the story. Some of it is going via Cyprus, but a chunk of it will most assuredly turn out to be going through Scottish and UK companies. We know of 20. I think that figure will grow. So this problem is only going to get visibly bigger as time goes by.
Ian Fraser.
Well, I think, you know, the first thing would be to regulate the company formation businesses that promote them, these corporate vehicles. You know, I think that might be a good starting point. At the moment, they don't seem to be regulated at all. I think perhaps increasing the disclosure requirements on the 1907 Act to ensure that, you know, more information should be disclosed, including the exact nature of the beneficial owners, because that isn't clear when you just have to declare general partners and limited partners. That's the point. Within a Scottish RP, there aren't any directors. It's just what's called general partners, which can be another company, and limited partners, which is normally another company. There are no named directors or nominee directors or anything. That's all that exists. But as far as, you know, what is the British and Scottish government actually doing to address this problem, the answer is very little. After pressure from the OECD and following an agreement on beneficial ownership principles made at the G8 summit in Northern Ireland in June 2013, the UK government did tighten up disclosure requirements relating to certain types of companies. But in fact, the change of rules only apply to limited companies and not to limited partnerships. So they basically left the, you know, what I call the Wild West of limited partnerships untouched. And I think this was a huge error on the part of the government.
Right, because everyone's got their eye on what's going to happen with the developments around those agreements between governments to have central registers of the real owners of companies. And the Tax Justice Network pointed out really quickly that their idea of leaving out trusts from these registers was going to create a nice big loophole. So would you put the limited partnerships we've been talking about in the same category as trusts in terms of them being outside the framework of disclosure? Richard Smith.
Yes, absolutely. And there is this problem with tackling the thing piecemeal. It would be nice if just once someone would tackle the whole shooting match across the board and put in, you know, sensible disclosure requirements that would then assist banks to do their anti-money laundering job. One knows really what sort of information banks need to do that. And it should be standardized across all of these vehicles. They can all hold bank accounts. They should all have the same basic underlying information associated with them for access, at least by banks and ideally by the public as well, because banks can slip up, as we know, from time to time. So, yes, it shouldn't be done piecemeal. But at the moment, all the signs are that the legal changes are going to go in piecemeal, which leaves an abundance of loopholes open for who knows how long in the future. I think it's getting this idea of beneficial ownership disclosure straight for limited partnerships. That's the big idea. A sort of lesser idea would be to simply bar certain jurisdictions from being able to host companies that could then be partners of Scottish limited partnerships or English limited partnerships, come to that. You know, a blacklist of 20 or 30 or 50 or whatever it is, jurisdictions where you just say, sorry, we're not going to accept registrations where the general limited partner is a company in one of these dodgy jurisdictions. I think that would do it ad hoc. And I think that could be done straight away. I think it might be that it requires legislative change. If it does, that should bloody well happen straight away.
Ian Fraser.
It's just laughable when you hear Cameron claiming that, you know, Britain's leading the world in tackling corruption or something. To be charitable, you could just say it's because the government doesn't really know and they're just semi-oblivious or lazy. Or, you know, I suppose the other answer is they think that having secrecy vehicles or confidentiality vehicles based in the UK might help business. I don't know.
TaxCast listeners may remember that back in November 2014, I interviewed Daria Kalenyuk of the Anti-Corruption Action Centre in Ukraine on the TaxCast. Moldova shares some similarities with Ukraine, and not only that it's in a geopolitically sensitive region caught between Russia and the West. By the time of the Ukrainian Revolution, when President Yanukovych was ousted from power, he and his associates had stolen so much money there was only $500,000 left in the state coffers. A good deal of that was facilitated by the financial systems of their European neighbours, just like the Moldovan bank fraud.
Yanukovych and his associates, they laundered billions from state budget using shell corporations, both in Ukraine and abroad. The state budget was absolutely empty. The problem in Ukraine is that law enforcement agencies is being used for years to cover corruption cases and to represent the interests of those in power. And because of that, you feel impunity in power. And there is still a high risk that in Ukraine, another Yanukovych will return to Ukraine.
How do Ukrainians feel, or how do you feel about the fact that so much of this money ended up in places like the City of London? You mentioned Cyprus already as a big beneficiary of the theft that has been going on in Ukraine.
We see that when Europe wants us to change and asks that we have to change, Europe has to change itself as well. It's not enough only to change Ukraine. If they want to prevent corrupt capital to flow into the EU, they can do this. It's profitable to get this cash, and it looks like for the benefit of the developed countries to receive proceeds of corruption. So they seem not to be corrupt themselves, and I think it's not right.
At the time of this interview, Ukraine had just become the first country to implement a register of beneficial owners to try to limit the possibility of another Yanukovych robbing Ukrainians blind again. I went on to ask her about the fact that governments talking about setting up their own beneficial ownership registers were planning to exclude trusts and foundations. And in the light of the Moldovan bank fraud, I could have thrown in Scottish limited partnerships as well.
No way. Please don't do this. Excluding trusts will mean that all money will flow to trusts. And in Ukrainian realities, it means that the companies will be registered from BVI to Liechtenstein or UK trust. And in Ukrainian register, they will report these trustees, these lawyers, as beneficial owner. They will lie, but it will take us really, we'll have to do lots of job to reveal that it was lie, to make these companies accountable, to hold them responsible for their lie.
Richard Smith.
It is destabilizing Moldova. You can't take 10%, 15% of annual GDP out of a country without hitting everyone in the pockets. And it's a bad look for the City of London and the UK. We're supposed to be democratic and free of corruption. And yet here we are facilitating, if not, hosting some of the most egregious and destabilizing corruption you could possibly imagine. We've seen what's happened to Ukraine, sort of imploding, breaking out into civil war. One doesn't want to sketch the same sort of apocalyptic picture for Moldova. It wouldn't be great if there was civil unrest and worse in Moldova too. And it's entirely conceivable. It's incredibly irresponsible and not good neighbourship to tolerate this kind of thing so blithely. And yet that's what the UK is doing.
You've been listening to The Taxcast. You can read Ian Fraser's work on www.ianfraser.org and look for Richard Smith on the Naked Capitalism blog on www.nakedcapitalism.com. We'll be back next month.